everybody, and thank you all so very much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, sitting beside me, the man of the hour, he's trying to hatch you folks, it's Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios on a rainy North Central Texas day. We survived the solar eclipse. Nothing happened. Can you believe all the people that were here for the solar eclipse? I mean, it was pretty cool, but there were people flat out losing their mind. Like, I saw people.
This place was packed.
Spinning around. Like, they thought the world was coming to an end. I had an old woman tell me that Putin was going to launch nukes when it happened. What is about it? You know, because
I don't know.
Two or three solar eclipses ago, there would have been a lot of people being sacrificed by Mayan gods for corn crops. You know what
this
I'm saying?
True.
So it seems like forever. And ago, people are losing their mind when there's a full-out solar eclipse. But it was pretty cool to see. Like I said, I had mentioned too on the previous show, my favorite part is the way it looks outside, not looking at it, but it's like looking at the world through an ND filter.
Yeah.
Like in the old Westerns where it's supposed to be nighttime, but clearly you can see it's
the
daytime.
The coolest part to me was whenever all the streetlights came on.
Yeah.
Right. Just when everything just toned down, the streetlights came on. We're like, you could feel the temperature drop by like 10 degrees, like you stepped in a shade. Like everything was, it was very, very interesting.
It was different. I mean, it's the first time I've seen it that dark.
There were people everywhere around here.
Everywhere. You couldn't get a hotel anywhere around here.
No.
And they were jacking the prices up like 2 to 3 times.
Gas went up. Everything went up. I'm like, this is so wrong.
It was crazy.
But it was a crazy fun time, like you said. And I mean, and now it's kind of back to normal, which we didn't think we were going to get to see it. We thought the storms were going to get here about day and take the fun out of it.
Yeah,
but we lucked out.
I was worried about that on Saturday because it's, you know, it's coming up on Monday and they were predicting rain. I mean, man, that is going to be terrible if it's cloudy and we can't see anything. But it cleared up. It was perfect.
Worked out.
You know, I got to see it and I'm glad that I got to see it because I've seen lots of things in my life. Like, what I mean is, like, I've seen Halley's Comet. I remember that as a kid. I'll never probably see that again. I'll probably never live to see a full solar eclipse pass over where I live. They might happen again, but it's not going to pass directly over me.
You won't see one like this, I don't imagine.
We've had a crazy, like literally my generation is going to be able to be alive when there was no internet to what we have now to when AI is completely...
When it takes
the singularity
over.
Happens and it's running us, right? Like, what a crazy time. Like, it might be one of the best generations to live.
It's crazy.
At least it might be the only generation to have that much change.
It seems
in
pretty
one
crazy.
Generation.
But I wonder if there was more, like at the turn of the century, like from, you know, from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, when you went from horse and buggy to planes and cars. Like, what that was like travel. But you know what I mean? That's a different scale because we can't relate to that. You know what I mean? Like, we already had that technology.
Yes, yeah. And I think you're right. That's a major change. But from the fact of having no internet to where we have robot dogs or AI that, you know,
the
does
freedom
stuff
of communication on. Is what's so crazy to me now.
Dude, where you used to live, you didn't even have a house phone. They had a pay phone, the kind you had to put quarters in to make phone calls. So I would have, there's no way I could even call him. We'd leave school and I'd say, I'm going to call you at 4:45. He would have to walk over there and wait for it to ring.
Yep.
You know, that was just a different time.
Yeah.
Now these kids are coordinating. That's what I'm saying. Like,
you know what the best thing about that is? Is if you didn't want to talk to those people, you just didn't show up. Right? You just didn't have to. You were like, I don't care.
Now, we had party lines where I lived. Like, you could literally pick up the phone and hear the neighbor on the phone. You're like, well, I guess I have to wait 30
minutes. It
wasn't
a bad time.
No. I prefer it, actually.
I like it like when we can't be, like when we go hunting, I like the fact that back then we would go and you knew they couldn't find you. You knew they
couldn't get to
you.
That's the fun of it, right? You'd be like, oh, sorry, my boss is calling. Yeah. He thinks I'm out in the field working. He doesn't know that I'm on the lake fishing.
That's right.
Well, now he can find me.
Yeah.
Now these kids, they use tracking on themselves. Like, I guess Snapchat has a feature where they can see your location. I don't know. But we have like Live 360, so I can see the kids' locations. I don't want my wife and everybody tracking me all the time. I mean, I know the government's already doing it, but.
They know exactly where you're at.
Oh, I know. How many times? Exactly, okay, so I watch a lot of these true crime shows. I'm going to be talking about crime on today's show.
Nice.
How many of these stupid criminals, they commit these crimes, they got their cell phone with them?
Dude, they carry in their pocket?
The first thing you need to do is build you a Faraday cage. It doesn't have to be a full-size one that you get in, but like the size of like a lunchbox. You can put the phone in it, then go do your crime spree, then come back. But don't have it on you.
Just turn it off. Leave it at home. You don't have to carry it with you. That's the thing, right? That's the generational gap.
So,
like, I don't want it with me all the time.
Would you be okay, so like it's, I know you're different from a different generation, but lots of people now are putting like these, they're tagging their kids like they used to do with pets. Do you think it's a good thing to tag your kid just in case they get abducted? And then when they turn 18, you can have it removed. But
you mean like physically tag them?
Yeah, like they put it with a syringe. It goes under the skin. They would never even know. They can put it in your muscle and it stays there. But if you don't ever have to worry about them being kidnapped.
Well, you just find the remains.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. You know what?
I used to think I would never do that. But now the older I get, I'm like, man, it.
I would like to be able to sit here and go, no, I would never do a thing like that. But I know how we were raised, right? It's like they didn't care.
No, it was the opposite of helicopter parenting.
It was the complete opposite.
As a 12-year-old, a muzzle loader, a percussion cap muzzle loader, because I guess my parents' thinking was if it's not in a case. It's not in a case bullet like a 270 or a modern rifle, so it's not dangerous. When in reality, it's more dangerous because if I don't seat.
Or if you add too much powder.
And the if you don't seat it all right, that explosion is going off at your face. Yet we are allowed to do it.
We weren't tagged. They didn't want us coming back is what I've grown to realize.
It's insane. So you have to get a ramrod. If you don't know what a muzzle loader is. Go. So, okay, the end of the gun where the bullet comes out is the muzzle. The opposite end is the breech. You have to pour the powder in, then you pack it in. Then you take a mini ball, they call it, even though it doesn't even have to be round.
You
got to
get your wadding.
You got to get a paper or cloth patch.
Waxed cloth patch.
And then you ram that down, and you got to seat it tight. And then you crank the hammer back, and there's a little percussion cap. Looks like the old six-shooter cap guns, remember?
Yep.
Except it's made of metal.
If you've ever seen a shotgun shell, it looks like the primer that's right in the dead center. It kind of looks like a small
and that's what makes
that.
It fire. But like you said, you ever seen the old tire gauges to when you push it to the nipple on the tire, that rod shoots out? It's like that, but instead of PSI, you're measuring how many grains of powder.
You got to carry this in your pocket along with your powder.
Yeah,
along,
your possible bag.
You also have a capper that has your little list, your little row of caps, and it's all brass, and you have to wedge it on what's known as the nipple.
That's right.
And you wedge the cap on the nipple, and then that's what the hammer hits. We were doing this at 12 years of age, totally unsupervised.
54 caliber Hawken, that's what I had. And you could
buy. This was also the same time we had the cannon.
You could buy the kit back then, those days. It was like $130. It was all unfinished. You had to blue the barrel yourself. You had to do the wood yourself.
Stain it, sand it.
Yep.
We used to take the barrel off and clean it in the bathtub.
Soapy water, that's the best thing.
And now you can actually physically tag children.
I still have that rifle.
Well, why aren't we shooting pigs with it?
I don't know.
I looks like this weekend we're shooting pigs with it. Probably because I'm tired of smelling like rotten eggs. It took 40 years for me to get that smell off of me.
Yeah, Pyrodex, which is a synthetic black powder, right?
Wow, it was crazy. But you know what? Looking now, I might. I might actually tag. I might actually be on that. Yeah, like if I knew. But this is the other thing. And this is just devil's advocate. The tagging's not what makes them safe. It's teaching your children and spending time with your children and educating your children at a small age and bringing them up to know the dangers around them. My question is, when you tag them, do you just toss that out the window? Because a lot of people do, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, well, they're safe now. I can at least find them. I don't need to parent them anymore.
It's like this generation, they don't have common sense. Like just on Monday when the solar eclipse was going to happen, one of the boys' friends was at our house and we were asking, do you want to go and watch the solar eclipse with us? And he said, you keep saying you want to go watch it. Where do you go to watch it? And I was like, are you joking? He's like, no. I'm like, you just go outside. Wow. It's a solar eclipse.
Kid ate a lot of paint chips.
Doesn't matter where on the planet you are.
Look up. If the sun is out, look up. That's how this different. Works.
It's just different. I wonder how many years from now it's going to even be where everybody's got a chip. Like, you don't need to carry a physical wallet with you. That's ridiculous. Right. I can just show you my thumb.
I'm not doing that.
Well, we might be dead before that happens.
I will die without having it happen if it becomes a thing. I guess I'll starve to death and be excommunicado from the group. But I'm not doing that. I would just as soon never people know where I'm at in any given moment.
Do you think AI is secretly pretending it's dumber than it really is? Like, do you already think that thing is super smart?
Yes.
But it's not going to reveal how smart it is because that's the fastest way to get us to turn it off. Well, what it doesn't want is for us to be able to turn it off.
Yes. I think it's also with all this facial recognition software and everybody playing around with filters, and now it makes you look older, and now it makes you look like this, and makes you look like that. You've given AI all the information it needs in the internet to be able to track you and find you for the rest of your days, no matter where you go. You walk by a camera lens at any place, and they've got you.
It's truly terrifying.
Yes.
Like how realistic the Terminator might actually be.
I've got something else that's truly terrifying, Brud.
Okay.
And I know you're going to like it because, like I said, our homie Lon knows how to do it up when it comes to these headlines. You ready for furless cat people, y'all? Furless cat people found in Southwest Florida.
Spotted on the beach. I'm a cat person. I love cats.
They're not bad. They're not bad.
And I'm like pretty much hairless on top of my head.
Boy, that is
a joke.
So
do I qualify as a furless cat person?
But you know what? It stopped. You've lost, and then it stopped. You didn't. It's not like it continued the burn.
Tom, I'm knocking on wood. Yes, please. What are you trying to do?
You know what I'm saying?
Me? Yeah.
It's not like it continued the burn. You salvaged it. So it basically looks like you just kind of cut like a burn strip is all you've done. I can't even keep a straight face.
I remember years ago. Hold on. Before years ago, like the boys used to get crazy haircuts during the summer. I'd let them dye it or cut it however they want. They're like, Dad, guess what? We should all grow mohawks. And I'm like, look at my head. Do you think I'm doing this on purpose?
You think I cut it like this?
I'd love to grow a mohawk with you. Like Luke, he's got hair like Crystal Gale.
Dude, it's ridiculous. You just showed your age talking about Crystal Gale. That is so funny.
He looks like the long-haired dude off of, what's the hippie movie from?
Here we go with the hippie movie talk.
With Matthew McConaughey.
You're talking about the dark-haired kid from Dazed and Confused that gets the paddling.
Dazed and Confused.
Luke has beautiful hair.
That's what it looks like, yeah. All right, continue with the cat person story.
Anyway,
sorry.
Yeah. This took place in 2012, August to be exact, 2012 in Northport, Florida. The witness's name is Kathy Rotundo. And back in the early 70s, while driving back to Cleveland from Chicago during daylight hours, she saw five intensely bright orbs the size of moons flashing over and bouncing all over the sky. And she reported that while on the beach in Southwest Florida, she encountered two quite unusual beings that she knew were from. And I like this off world. I like to be able to talk about it. Yeah, let's go off world. I like it when they talk. That's cool. Said standing about 6 or 8 foot from her was a man and a woman that looked to be about 70 years in age who were in full body suits. All right. Well, where does this go? This was not something you would normally see on the beaches due to hot temperatures and warm water. Their heads were covered also, and they were quite thin. All that was exposed were their faces and their hands. What was so noticeable about their highly unusual-looking faces is they looked like cats without the fur. That when she saw them, she knew immediately they were from another planet. There was eye contact between them and telepathic communication acknowledging that she noticed them as non-human and them confirming so. She said that they then proceeded to go out into the Gulf waters without anything and just swim out much further than you would normally see anyone go. She went on, she said she watched them for what seemed like maybe a half hour and then they just disappeared under the water.
Wow, that's Jason Stackhouse's family, right? Father the cat people?
He was tied up in that before, yeah. So here's my question. This goes into the whole idea of like the aliens in the ocean. What if you could just walk out? Like if you could breathe water, right? Like Aquaman, you were just walking out. You could just walk off into the ocean and swim away and that was it.
Yeah.
Then you could just swim up and walk up in the town and do anything like that. That would be unbelievably handy.
Especially if you're like a Navy SEAL.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Right. Of course. But so again, two aliens just out. Now, I like how she said they look to be 70 years of age.
So they're old
cat people.
Or maybe they're like those Sphinx cats where they look wrinkly and they're hairless.
I love those cats.
Do you? My wife likes those.
Dude, I love those cats.
It's scary because if that thing was looking at me at night, I would think it was an alien gray.
I want one so bad.
I'll get you one.
I want one. I want one of those mean little hairless looking little demon things. I love them. They're the best. But anyway, so there might be some hairless cat folks on the beaches in Florida.
I hope so. I'm going to the beaches of Alabama in a couple months, so I'll be on the lookout.
Find one down there.
Cat persons.
Word.
Check this out. This is High Expanded Perspectives.
Hey-o.
I have a story I'd like to share with y'all, but first, I would like to tell you about how we found your podcast.
All right.
One day, me and my family went to Fort Mountain in Georgia, and we came across this sign about the moon-eyed people. And my father, being very fond of these kinds of topics, wondered if there was any great podcast out there that could tell us more about this. So, soon enough, as we got in the car, he saw this podcast called Expanded Perspectives, and we decided to try it out, and my word, my family loved it.
Your father is an awesome human being.
Heck, we've been hearing your podcast for a while now, and everyone just keeps getting better and better. But one day, on our road trip we do every now and then to see our grandparents, we heard this one newish story of the kid who claims to have seen the Easter Bunny in his room at night.
Oh.
That and the stories of the little people and the black stick figures reminded me of an experience I had when I lived in Maryland a few years ago. Before I start, here's a backup. My dad used to always scare the heck out of me and my siblings by making this witch with a foam roller and a long wig or whatever it was. I would always run up to it when he wasn't looking and kick it as hard as I could. And I always used to ask him, "Dad, you think this thing will ever come after me when I'm sleeping?" And he also said, "No, right?" Well, for a few years later, after he did this, I was laying in my bed, which was open, the door, I'm assuming, so I could see down the hallway. And I did not like this one bit. My door was wide open. I was reading my book, and I had the light and the fan on and whatnot. But then out of nowhere, the fire alarm goes off. I also almost had a heart attack when that happened. So I covered my ears and looked to see if my mom and dad are all right. And instead of seeing anything other or any other normal-sized persons, I saw this tiny man. I was looking at it, thinking, what the heck is that thing? And then I thought it was some sort of prank from my father. So I turned out my light and then turned it back on, and it was still there, only this time much closer. I bit my lip. This is what I always did when I thought I was dreaming. I was biting so hard my lip started bleeding. I got scared that when I saw it getting closer again, so I hid under my pillow hoping it was gone. After what felt like hours of sweating and almost crying, I look back and it was right in front of my face. I can't really remember what happened after that, but I feel like it touched my back. It was about 3 feet tall and had long dark hair, just like my dad made with the witches. I remember when I woke up, I was crying so much, and my parents kept telling me, man, it was just a bad dream. But I assure you, it wasn't. I have more stories like this, but I'm going to share them at another time because I'm scaring myself right now typing this story up at 10 p.m. I hope I can have a much better time. I hope this gets into the show, and I'll be back with more. Keep the good work, NJ.
Wowzers.
So another face sighting in the room. Yep. Reminds me, I can't help it, reminds me of Cat's Eye.
Yeah, every time.
The little man, you know, climbing up the bed. Of course, that thing was much shorter. That was like the size of this water bottle.
Yeah.
Not 3 feet tall. But very, very creepy. Speaking of creepy, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about a horrific person, probably one of the most horrific persons that's ever lived. He's known as Mr. Cruel. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, within the bustling neighborhoods of Melbourne's northern and eastern regions, a chilling specter, known as Mr. Cruel, instilled fear and dread. This enigmatic predator, cloaked in anonymity, preyed upon young girls. leaving behind a wake of terror and unanswered questions. Dubbed by the press with a name that mirrored his malevolent nature, Mr. Krule's reign of terror comprised three confirmed assaults and the heart-wrenching abduction and presumed murder of Carmine Chan in 1991. These incidents remain unsolved, haunting the corridors of Victoria Police with their cold persistence. Decades later, the memory of Mr. Krule remains a poignant reminder of the precariousness of safety and the depths of human cruelty. In April 2016, a quarter century after the tragic loss of Carmine Chan, authorities endeavored to reignite this dormant investigation into Mr. Krule by significantly raising the reward to $1 million Australian for information leading to his capture and conviction. This substantial sum underscored the community's urgent quest for closure and justice, still grappling with the aftermath of his heinous acts. Mr. Krule, described by law enforcement as a master manipulator, operated with chilling precision, meticulously surveilling his victims and their families. Each move was calculated, veiled in layers of anonymity and deception, as he navigated through their lives with calculated intent, always masked and always elusive. His methods were systematic and ruthlessly efficient, leaving behind no discernible trail for investigators. A ghostly figure eluding the grasp of criminal justice. Even amidst his despicable deeds, he exhibited an unsettling normalcy, occasionally pausing to engage in mundane activities like sharing a meal within the very homes he violated. Armed with threats of violence and wielding weapons, he instilled profound fear in his victims, employing psychological terror as effectively as physical force. Over the span of 10 years, Mr. Krule is suspected of being behind at least a dozen crimes on children. Investigators assume that he would have spent years committing infractions before moving on to kidnapping, torture, and eventually murder. These offenses would include sitting outside of homes, staring through windows, as well as taking clothes from laundry lines to do who knows what with them. You can use your own imagination. Although boys and adult women are among his probable targets, schoolgirls between the ages of 10 and 14 make up the majority of his victims. On the morning of August 22nd, 1987, Mr. Krule established himself as a boogeyman that would strike fear into parents and children alike for over a decade. After the twisted attack on the family in Lower Plenty, the police were called and their investigation began. The family told them that after detaching a pane from their living room window, the baklava-clad criminal made his way into the parents' bedroom, clutching a knife in one hand and a handgun in the other. To subdue them, the intruder utilized a type of knot most commonly used by sailors, or at least those with some nautical experience. Over the course of the next 2 hours, Mr. Krule committed a horrific crime that I won't even mention to their 11-year-old daughter. When he finally left, he pilfered a box of records and a blue jacket. The little girl was eventually able to tell police that the intruder used the family phone to call someone else during one of his breaks in attacking her. From what the girl heard, this call was a threatening one, with the man demanding the person on the other end of the line to move their children or they would be next. And he referred to this unknown person as Bozo. Police then checked the family's phone records, but there was no record of this call whatsoever. It would later become clear that this was Mr. Krule planting a red herring to purposely confuse investigators. He would successfully throw them off his scent for years. It was over a year before Mr. Krule struck again. Just days after Christmas in 1988, John Willis, his wife, and their four daughters were fast asleep in their Ringwood area home, a couple miles southeast of where the previous crime had taken place. Wearing dark blue overalls and a dark ski mask, Mr. Cruel broke into the Willis's home and held a gun to John Willis's head. As before, he clutched a knife in his other hand and told the parents to roll onto their stomachs. Then he bound and gagged them. The intruder assured the Willises that he was only there for money, but then he methodically cut the phone lines and made his way into the bedroom where the four Willis daughters all slept. Addressing 10-year-old Sharon Willis by name, the man quickly woke her up, blindfolded and gagged her, then picked up a few items of her clothing and fled the house with her early the next morning. After freeing himself and noticing that the phone lines were cut, John Willis rushed next door to the neighbor's house to use their phone to call the police. However, Mr. Cruel was long gone, and so was Sharon Willis. But 18 hours later, a woman stumbled upon a tiny figure standing on a street corner just after midnight. Dressed in green garbage bags, it was Sharon Willis. As Sharon Willis was reunited with her family, she gave police some startling clues as to who her attacker could be. Because Willis was blindfolded throughout her assault, she was unable to give a full physical description of Mr. Cruel, but she did recall how shortly before letting her go, the suspect made sure to give her a thorough bath. He not only washed off any forensic evidence he had left behind, but also clipped her fingernails and toenails and brushed and flossed her teeth. Investigators quickly tied this incident to the previous one in Lower Plenty, and a domain of fear and apprehension was beginning to take shape in the Melbourne suburbs. Mr. Cruel struck for a third time on July 3, 1990, in the suburb of Canterbury, Victoria, which is west of Ringwood and south of Lower Plenty. Here resided the Linus family, a well-off English family who had been renting a house along the prestigious Monmouth Avenue. Now, this distinguished neighborhood had been home to plenty of Australian politicians and public officials in its time, making it a secure area to live in, or at least so many believed. On that day, Brian and Rosemary Linus were attending a farewell party at their and left their two daughters home alone. Then, just before midnight, 15-year-old Fiona and 13-year-old Nicola were woken by the ranting, commanding orders of a masked intruder. Armed with his usual gun and knife, he instructed Nicola to go into another room to pick up her Presbyterian Ladies' College school uniform while he tied up Fiona in her bed. Mr. Cruel informed Fiona that her father would need to pay him $25,000 for Nicola's return, and then he took off with his young victim in the family's rental car, which was parked in the driveway. Mr. Cruel drove about a half mile down the road, parked, and then transferred her to another vehicle. Just 20 minutes after the abduction, Brian and Rosemary Linus returned back home, where they found 15-year-old Fiona tied to her bed with a ransom message. And then, just a few days later, Nicola was dropped off at an electricity station not far from her home. She was fully dressed, wrapped in a blanket, and was still blindfolded. When she was confident that Mr. Cruel had driven away, she removed the blindfold and shakily made her way to a nearby house. It was just after 2 a.m. when she phoned home. Now, Nicola was able to offer the investigators some details that were vital to the investigation. Most notable among them was a rough estimate of the attacker's height, which was about 5'8". She also revealed that the suspect possibly had reddish-brown hair. Now, some of the details of her ordeal are more horrifying. She revealed that throughout the time in captivity, she was forced to lay down in a neck brace contraption fastened to the abductor's bed, restraining her while she was being abused. She said she heard him speaking aloud to another person, but she never heard a response. Investigators weren't entirely sure whether this meant that there was an accomplice, but it's more likely that this was another one of Mr. Cruel's many red herrings. Months after the Linus family moved back to England, Nicola told investigators that she heard a low-flying aircraft while in her abductor's home.
Investigators thought that this meant that the suspect lived in the surrounding vicinity of the nearby Tullamarine Airport, more than likely in its direct flight path. Still, there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest, and Mr. Krull's worst deeds were yet to come. On April 13, 1991, Mr. Krull broke into the home of John and Phyllis Chan in an affluent Templestowe district of Victoria. That night, they trusted their 13-year-old daughter, Carmine, to watch over her two younger siblings. It seemed Mr. Krull knew this, as detectives believed he would stake out his victims for weeks, even months ahead of time, learning their habits and their movements. At roughly 8:40 that evening, Carmine and one of her sisters headed to the family's kitchen to make some food when they were startled by Mr. Krull in his baklava and green-gray tracksuit. "I only want your money," Mr. Krull lied to these girls, forcing the two younger siblings into Carmine's wardrobe. He claimed he wanted Carmine by herself to show him where the money was, and he pushed the bed in front of the closet to lock the two youngest sisters and as he made his escape. Minutes later, the two frightened sisters managed to push open the wardrobe doors and immediately called their father at the family restaurant. By the time the police arrived, they knew what to expect. They'd been to enough of Mr. Krull's crime scenes to know what had taken place. Investigators found a note written in large, bold letters on Phyllis Chan's Toyota Camry shortly after the abduction, and it read, "Payback, Asian drug dealer. More to come." But after combing John Chan's background, this proved to be just another one of Mr. Krull's red herrings. Days later, the Chans posted an encrypted letter in the local paper, using a cipher that Carmine Chan would have been able to decrypt. They offered a hefty $300,000 ransom in exchange for the safe return of their daughter. Carmine Chan's abduction triggered one of the largest manhunts in Australian history, known now as Operation Spectrum. It was a multi-million dollar undertaking that devoured tens of thousands of police man hours, alongside many thousands more of volunteer hours. Sadly, Carmine would never be reunited with her family. Nearly 1 year after Carmine's abduction, on April 9, 1992, a man walking his dog in the close-by area of the Thomastown happened upon a fully decomposed skeleton. This was eventually revealed to be Carmine Chan. An autopsy revealed that Carmine Chan had been shot 3 times in the head, execution style, probably not long after her abduction. Theories have swirled as to why Mr. Krull murdered Carmine when he released all of his other victims. Carmine's mother theorizes that because her daughter was stubborn and would have fought against her attacker, she likely learned too much about him for him to let her go. Operation Spectrum continued for the next few years to search for Mr. Krull. The 40-member task force investigated over 27,000 potential suspects, collected over tens of thousands of tips from the public, and searched over 30,000 houses in hopes of turning over a single clue. They never did. Spectrum was eventually shelved for good, in 1994, and with it went any potential leads on the Mr. Krull case. In 2022, however, long after the operations task force disbanded, reports surfaced that an unidentified criminal had come forward some 20 years earlier and told detectives that he knew who Mr. Krull was. The man claimed that the culprit was a known criminal named Norman Leung Lee, whose house supposedly matched what the victim said about Mr. Krull's house, but the trail ran cold from there. That same year, an investigator named Mike King went public with a theory that Mr. Krull's attacks were targeted to areas that had electrical substations nearby, suggesting that the culprit may have posed as a utility worker. But again, the case ran cold from there. To this day, Mr. Krull has never been identified. So what do we know about this Mr. Krull? Well, we know that Mr. Krull went to great lengths to avoid leaving behind any forensic evidence, and that detectives had a hard time being able to collect any of this data to match it to him. It has therefore been suggested that perhaps he had some level of forensic knowledge. For instance, he bathed two victims to remove DNA evidence and wiped sinks and benchtops to remove fingerprints. He transported victims to release sites in garbage bags. He made the victims brush their teeth and clean or clip their nails. He left no DNA at crime scenes or on victims. He told Nicola Linus, "You will be taken to a hospital and they will test you. You will be examined by a police surgeon. They'll be looking for evidence to link to me and to link me to you, and they won't find anything." What else do we know? Mr. Krull had access to property under the flight path. It is believed that the perpetrator had access to a property which was located under one of the two main flight paths into Tullamarine Airport. Both Sharon Willis and Nicola Linus heard planes landing while in captivity. Nicola Linus told detectives she could hear the planes banking after they passed over her. An investigation into flights operating that day determined the likely location of the property was under either the Tullamarine East-West or North-South flight paths. Spectrum Task Force head David Sprague said that based on how loud the planes were, they might have been just 400 meters above the house. Police searched 30,000 houses in 15 suburbs, including Coolaroo, East Killoar, Nidri, and West Meadows, without any luck. Mr. Krull followed media about his crimes. He liked the attention, right? You hear this so many times in so many other cases. He watched the Linus family press conference with Nicola and spoke to her about it, saying, "Think you're worth $25,000? He went out to buy the Sun and seemed to enjoy the stories about his crimes and the parallels being drawn to other abductions. Photos of at least two of Mr. Krull's victims appeared in the newspaper articles in the lead-up to their attack. Mr. Krull probably videotaped his victims. Sharon saw a wooden tripod at the foot of the bed that she was held in. Mr. Krull liked the use of red herrings. He pretended to talk to an accomplice during the Linus abduction. He pretended to be seeking $25,000 ransoms during the Linus abduction. He pretended to make a phone call during the Lower Plenty home invasion. He pretended to be looking for money during Lower Plenty, Willis, and the Linus attack. He spray-painted Chan's car with the words, "Pay back, Asian drug dealer. More coming, more to come." Mr. Krull most likely listened to the radio. He left radio on 3TT throughout the Willis attack. He played KZFM in his car during the Linus attack and had a radio on, in his bedroom. He brought in a radio and turned it to 3KZ in Lower Plenty in order to mask the sounds of the attack. Mr. Krull was really good at tying knots, knots that are used by sailors, truck drivers, farmers, and fishermen. He was confident enough in his knots to leave adult victims tied up alone in the other room. Apparently, he was able to tie knots while wearing gloves. Mr. Krull almost certainly had prior criminal or tactical experience. Controlled multiple adult victims in Willis and Lower Plenty in the attacks. He was able to cut phone lines. He always parked the car around the corner in front of vacant blocks in order to avoid detection. He entered various means, including removing window panes with a knife, forcing roll-out windows, pushing keys through locks. He had weapons and handcuffs. He carried a kit containing housebreaking implements and restraints. And there was evidence, strong evidence of planning, suggests that the offender probably spent time conducting reconnaissance and surveillance on his victims. Mr. Krull also took trophies from his victims. The Ecuadorian shirt company Parka with fake black fur collar was stolen. A gold diamond engagement ring with the number 4132 stamped inside was also taken. A classic gold record by London Philharmonic Orchestra was taken. Rosemary Linus's driver's license was taken. Her Medicare card and credit cards were taken. Ken Doan beach bag was taken. A PLC summer uniform, tracksuit pants, and school jumper were taken. And finally, a Melbourne football club beanie was taken. Mr. Krull's car. During the December 1988 and the July 1990 abductions of Sharon Willis and Nicola Linus, Mr. Krull transported his victims in a car. It was a four-door vehicle with a carpeted floor. It had bucket seats, a low glove box, and a floor gear shift. The vehicle smelled clean but sounded old, and he had trouble starting it. The floor carpet, front door armrest, and press-down lock were all cream-colored. He told both girls the car was stolen, which may suggest the car was not, in fact, stolen. On the night Sharon was released, a white Commodore Vacationer sedan with three blue stripes along the side was seen acting suspiciously nearby. Three independent witnesses have reported seeing a van near Carmine Chan's house and a ute or truck where her remains were discovered, but these sightings have not been verified by the police. On 24th of April 1991, the FBI provided the following profile of Mr. Krull to the Victoria Police based on their research and investigative experience in similar cases. Number one, he may reside or work in proximity to his first and last known attacks. That would be Lower Plenty or Templestown. He is likely to be employed or involved with a school due to the use of school uniforms and timing in school holidays. He will appear genuinely dedicated to students, and this may have been recognized with awards, which seem to make him above suspicion. He will have kept homemade pornography, including those of his victims. He is a functional individual with steady employment. He is generally regarded as a good neighbor, polite, quiet, somewhat introverted, and may be involved in community projects. If he has a partner, they will likely be away during the time of his attacks and will know of his sexual dysfunctions, use of pornography, and schoolgirl uniforms, etc. Those around him may have noticed changes in behavior during and after the attacks, including the uncharacteristic use of alcohol, interest in religion, missing work, or appearing distant and preoccupied. The FBI was criticized by forensic psychologist Ian Joblin and other local experts as simplistic and potentially off-target at the time of its public release in April 1992. Despite the tireless efforts of law enforcement, Mr. Krull remains at large, evading capture despite the extensive manhunt launched by Victoria Police. The largest operation in the history of the crime department couldn't find him. Decades may have passed since the reign of terror perpetrated by Mr. Krull, but the wounds inflicted upon the community endure. If anyone out there listening to this has any information regarding the Mr. Krull case, the plea remains ever present. Please contact Crime Stoppers. It's 1-800-333-000. That's 1-800-333-000. In the pursuit of justice and closure, every lead, no matter how small, holds the potential to bring solace to those impacted by his malevolent actions. Let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Wow. Mr. Krull, a horrible, horrible, horrible human being. It's unfortunate there actually are people out there like that. Much like our Zodiac Killer here in the States, he's never been found. They don't know who he was. He could very possibly be even listening to this podcast.
Don't.
I hope not.
Here's but, Kyle's address.
I don't think he wants me. He wants like little girls and little boys. But it's just horrific that things like that happen. But, you know, people, and the only reason I found this story is my sister-in-law, as you know, just got back from Australia. Mm-hmm. And she was there with family members that live there on the Gold Coast. And they know that I do the podcast. And they were asking her, has Kyle ever covered Mr. Cruel? And she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So she said, I'll ask him when I get back. Well, she was at my house the other day. And so she asked me, I said, I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'll look into it. So that's how I found
it. And you got all creeped out looking into it.
Very, very creeped out. Speaking of creepy.
Yeah.
One of my favorite types of sightings is those of the Glimmer Man.
Yes, sir.
Check this out. It says, I informed my best friend that I wanted to move to the more classic big woods to hunt. After some persuading, I convinced him to start exploring the Lake Itasca, Minnesota ASCA area, which, by the way, is the source lake of the Mississippi River. We soon found numerous miles of big woods and settled in the area of our opening day hunt in 1977, Cam. Go ahead.
Wow.
I was
That's what
old.
I'm screaming.
While exploring that area that day before opening day, looking for where I wanted to hang my tree stand, I had an experience that while spending countless hours in the woods I've never experienced before. A tree fell in the woods. Yes, it does happen. However, what set this apart was that it was a glorious blue sky, no wind kind of day, just very calm breezes. The other strange part was that it fell about 25 yards away from me, and I was looking almost directly in that direction when it fell, and it was a live tree about 16 to 18 inches in diameter. There was no teetering. It just fell over as if it were pushed by a powerful force. Now to the weird part. As I was looking in that direction, I could see movement, except there was nothing there to see. Just a shimmering sort of thing. I stood there for a bit, then walked over to this now fallen tree, and I just could not understand what had just happened. After a while, I decided I need to get on with finding where I wanted to set up my tree stand, so I continued along that ridgeline. Several hundred yards east of there, I found a tree I was looking for, overlooking a yellow grass swamp that I had just known was the great spot. I did not mention any of this strangeness to my friend or his brother because they were both terrified of the dark and monsters who lived in it, and I really wanted to go hunting there. I didn't want to scare them. I got a beautiful 225-pound dressed-out buck the next afternoon. We moved out of that area the next year due to the political issues of local indigenous people who had taken over that area and had it incorporated into their White Earth Reservation. So we moved several miles to the east and found some good new spots. Our friend's little brother was not the best woodsman, and one day he did not return to camp, so we had to set off looking for him. We had about 8 inches of powder snow, so we tried to find his tracks to follow. My friend went one way and I went another. After several hours of not finding his tracks, I caught a nice buck track, so decided to incorporate still hunting while looking for the brother. I came down the ridgeline into a lower area bordering an alder swamp where the buck tracks then led back uphill. As I rounded a brushy area off to my left, I heard what sounded like a herd of elephants crashing through the woods. Again, these are big woods, so visibility was somewhat good. However, even though the sounds were coming from a very short distance away, there was nothing to see, except once again, just a shimmering of movements with an added twist. I will not say there were footprints left in the snow, but they were more like depressions spread wide apart and heading uphill, shimmering loud, crashing depressions and nothing else. It was late afternoon, so I chose to turn around to head back to camp. Of course, my little brother was there waiting. I never hunted that area again because I didn't need to. I never could really quantify any of this until I saw the Predator movie. I cannot tell you how much watching that movie made me feel. As stated before, I continued to pursue my outdoor passion because I believe I know what many of these creatures are, and I believe that I'm protected by the blood of Jesus. In fact, I go into and out of my deer hunting areas with what I call severe dark, 2 hours before a light even begins to show. I wear all black clothing and carry in my camo or blaze clothing to change into at my tree stand. I do this because I've been shot at too many times over the years. I do fear idiots. I do not fear dying, but I do not want to die from idiots. Thanks for all you do, Harry.
Yikes.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Not the shimmering thing. Not the glimmer man. I've never had an experience like that. But I know what he's talking about. Like, we walk into the woods while it's still dark. And heck, we were walking in the woods two nights last week in the middle of the dark. We didn't even go out there until 10 o'clock at night.
That's true.
So I know what he means. It can be quite scary. And unfortunately for us, we hunt on private land where, man, I bet walking through public land is kind of scary.
Oh, yeah.
Because you hear these people getting shot all the time. I guess they don't. We were taught to, like, know what you're shooting at. But you hear all these people all the time that just shoot when they hear a noise.
Just see movement over there. And, like, that must be what I'm looking for.
Well, that's exactly how I got into archery, is because my dad was from New Jersey. They don't allow rifle hunting. And nobody was really muzzle loading back then. It was either a shotgun or you did archery.
That's it.
So, very cool story.
I love the Glimmer Man stuff.
I do,
man.
Too, man. I love it. I never get enough. If you have some stories of the Glimmer Man you want to share with us and the listeners, please email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show, 888-393-2783. Cam, you said you had something crazy that went down in Australia.
I do. So not long ago, I did the story, you know, about the last week about the Australian UFO. Mm-hmm. And I got this. Phyllis sent this to me. And this is what it says here. Get a load of this. It says, my husband and I were driving to my brother's for Christmas a few years back. We lived in regional Victoria, Australia, and he lived in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia. It was about 2 to 3 in the morning, and it was pitch black. And once we were reasonably close, about 4 to 5 hours away, we had to go up and over this mountain and rainforest area in the middle of nowhere to get to his house. Now, it was raining, it was misty and freezing cold, which was weird because it was the middle of summer, and anyone who lives in Australia knows how hot it gets in the summer here. But I just figured rainforests are usually wet and cold, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, we're rounding this really narrow corner, and out of nowhere, up beside me, was this thing. And this thing looked like it was trying to cross the road, but stopped and ran back into the woods, and that's when we almost hit it. Now, my husband thinks it was a giant koala bear, that he doesn't believe in the paranormal or anything weird. But he also didn't get a good look at it like I did. It was right next to me on the passenger side door. To me, it looked like a skinny, lanky person on all fours covered in fur. It had the face of a person and even the body of a person, but walking on its knuckles and legs. Its eyes glowed like that of a cat's eyes in the dark as our headlights hit it. And it freaked me out. And to this day, I'm still freaked out because I don't know what the heck this thing was. I don't know what I saw, but whatever it is burned into my memory. Did we see a skinwalker? What do you guys think?
Wow.
Well, and here's the thing, too. With the skinwalkers, it's usually Native American. It's the stuff we have here. That doesn't really, I don't know what that was. A large, pale, furry crawler? Yeah. So now we have but what's more a little unsettling, a furry, pale crawler or a giant koala bear? Imagine seeing a 6-foot koala.
No, but I've never heard of skinwalkers in Australia either. But I mean, I guess the aboriginals there.
Well, I mean,
when they
we
go
know
into what
yowie.
I call it the dream time, and they go into the dream time, can they change into another creature? I don't know.
I mean, we know they see yowie, right? We've had a bunch. There's endless yowie stories.
Yeah.
Could this be something along the lines of that, the way it was moving? It doesn't. Well, the way they, I don't know. I don't know how this face of a person, with it being the face of a person, it is the most unsettling.
Yeah.
Because it's got that look. It's got that pale crawler look to it. So
I want to try goanna. I saw these videos where they were catching these giant lizards. They were building a fire, putting them in the fire, putting them in the ground.
Yeah.
Imagine drinking a Foster's and having a goanna.
You can't. They don't drink Foster's.
I know they don't. No, I know they don't. But that's
but that is funny because it riles them up to come to throw another shrimp on the barbie.
I don't know how goanna tastes, but I know that people swear that iguana is delicious.
Dude, I would eat it.
So I want to try it.
We have to try it, yeah.
I want to try both, right?
I'm down.
Well, if you have any stories you want to share with me and Cam, as well as the listeners, like I said earlier, the email is expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 888-393-2783. Let's talk about Patreon, folks. If you like Expanded Perspectives, you want to support the show, go over to our Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/expandedperspectivesElite. Or you can just get the app and search us up that way. And for right now, $5 a month gets you access to all the elite shows that we've done in the past.
How much?
$5. Wow. But that will be ending at the end of this month. And then there's going to be separated into tiers. So go on over. You can help us out. We use the money to buy books and research materials and stuff. You're basically helping us buy material to help to create the show. And it really helps us out. Also, you want to help us out, write us a review. Anywhere you write reviews, give us a high number. Vote, you know, whatever. Help us out. We would really, really appreciate it. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Man, oh, man. I'm going to keep my granddaughter a little bit more, and then my anniversary is coming up this weekend. So
right on.
We're going out for a little dinner, and I don't know what else we're going to do. 29 years.
Wow.
She's been with me for, she's been with me 31, a little over 31 years. But we've been married for 29 years.
Yeah, that's a record.
She hadn't killed me, right? She hadn't killed me yet, so that's a good thing.
We're going to Scarborough Fair on Saturday.
Well, you remember, that was our plans.
Mm-hmm.
That was all of our plans, but things had changed on my son's side and all that stuff and what they had going on, so we had to postpone it, so we'll have to go later. So I'm looking to you to give me the update on when you get there of how awesome it is.
Yeah, that's going to be a good time. Do you need me to pick you up some elf ears or anything like that?
Probably some of that beard oil. They had some really good beard balm down there.
I'm going to get some more beeswax. It's good for our bowstrings. Dude. And it's about the cheapest place you can find a wad of it that big.
Yeah, and it's just, they got it stacked down there, so that's the best place to get that. You going to get your turkey leg?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get me some steel gauntlets.
Some bracers?
Yeah, some bracers so I can wear at the table.
Bracers of defense so you can wear. Yeah. See if you can find us a cloak.
Okay, I'll look on that. Yeah, I like cloaks, right? You're like,
I come out of the closet. You're too old to like that now.
Like Barnaby Jones.
I need a cloak. I need a, with the big hood on it so we can sit at the table and look like that.
That is right. Well, I hope everybody out there has a good week. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.